Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:05 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is March 9th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. The week started out generally in fairly negative territory. We've had downward dynamics across a whole range of stock markets. And into the end of the week, the majority have recouped the most of the decline. We've had some impressive bounces across a number of markets, not least in Japan, where the Nikkei was up an additional 1 2/3% in here today. It touched the 10,000 area. That's significant. It was retesting the 8,000 area at the end of November. So the markets rallied, give or take, about 25% in just the last 3 or 4 months. So that's really quite impressive indeed. It's been it's certainly been bolstered by the fact that the yen has been weakening, particularly over the last couple of months. What we are now presented with in a number of cases is a higher reaction low for a number of these stock markets. The size of the downward dynamic that we saw earlier this week was enough to initiate a reaction. We've had a very big bounce across a number of markets, particularly today, where the US economic data was a bit more positive. Now, this was a week where there was quite a bit of news. The Greeks were able to pull off the biggest debt swap in history, or the biggest debt restructuring in history today. They did activate their CACs, so they forced some of their creditors to participate. Now, that's a default by any other name, whether ISDA, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, decides that that is a default or not is open to question. It's certainly come under quite a deal of pressure from the Europeans. Elsewhere this week, we saw that gold pulled back rather sharply and has been rallying for the last few days. It's back above the 1700 level. Silver, having been as low as $32 at one point during the week, is back above $34.30. Platinum has been perhaps less volatile than either gold or silver, and it's up an additional $27.90 in here today. It was as low as $1,600 at one point during the week. It has been a good week for stock markets generally. Now, today we saw that the dollar was quite a bit stronger, particularly against the pound and the euro. It was strong right across a whole range of currencies, but particularly strong against the euro. Now, the euro touched the 135 area about 2 weeks ago, and it's been pulling back from that area since. Considering the amount of money that has been pumped into the European economy, and particularly the banking sector by the ECB, and the liquidity injections that are currently taking place, it is hard to make a bullish case for the euro, particularly with such a large number of the respective stock markets, or sorry, the respective economies in recession. I think it's 6 of the 17 eurozone members are in a recession at present. This was a week in which we saw a couple of contract changes in some of the government bond markets, and that has left quite large gaps in some of those charts. That reflects the backwardation. Now, backwardation is normally an indication that there's a short-term supply deficit in some of these markets. Demand for a safe haven remains really quite intense, and that's likely to remain the case for a while longer. However, what we're starting to see is a change in the way the market is functioning. What we saw in the latter half of last year was some extreme volatility. There was a great deal of uncertainty on the monetary policy front. There might still be a great deal to worry about. People are still worried about the economy. They're worried about what's going to happen in China. They're still worrying about the European situation. They're worried about the Greek restructuring. They're worried about the absence of a growth strategy for Europe. They're also worried about the oil price. But what we are seeing is that monetary policy, the perception of what's happening with monetary policy has cleared up considerably since December. The ECB has embarked upon a record increase in its balance sheet, $1 trillion in the last couple of months, and there's no indication that they've really stopped at that. There was some speculation during the week that with inflationary pressures expected to be a bit firmer in the Eurozone, primarily because of the oil price, that the ECB wouldn't be able to lower interest rates any further. What they will likely argue is that with such a large portion of the currency union at risk of recession, that the commodity price inflation is a temporary factor. Then they will also argue that their increase in liquidity injections into the European economy can be sanitized and that it will not have an inflationary impact. Now, veteran subscribers will be aware of our view on that. Central banks, on the other hand, argue that the velocity of money has been declining, therefore they are justified in increasing the supply of money to make up for the loss of velocity. What they have not been able to demonstrate is that they are capable of removing that liquidity when they need to combat inflationary pressures. The Bank of Japan has adopted an inflation target. They are selling yen. I think the exodus of a large number of manufacturers from the Japanese market finally galvanized policymakers, particularly at the Bank of Japan, that something had to be done about the strength of the currency. And today, the dollar was particularly strong against the yen. It went through the 82 level for the first time. It's been ranging below that area for the last couple of weeks. It broke upwards in here today. I used the chart library's high-low filter about a month ago to identify shares that had hit a new high within, at least a 12-month new high within the last 5 days. I got 92 results. I did exactly the same thing a month later today, and I got 322. So the Japanese market's breadth is expanding. There are more shares beginning to break out of lengthy base formations or lengthy ranges. The banking sector continues to outperform, and the number of banks that are hitting at least new 12-month highs has increased substantially in the last month. Now, the Japanese banking sector had been written off by the majority of investors, and the Japanese stock market had been written off because it's been such a remarkable disappointment for the last number of years. But everything that the stock market is doing right now suggests recovery. It's contingent on the continued weakness of the yen. The yen is still really very firm against a majority of currencies, but it is weakening. Provided it continues to weaken, that will provide a significant tailwind for the stock market. And it is interesting that the stock market is rallying faster than the yen is weakening. So this has been a catalyst that we've pointed out for a number of years, but it's also something that the market has been broadly aware of. And with that additional piece falling into place, I think investors are increasingly rolling in behind this momentum move in Japanese stocks. Now, the 10,000 area on the Nikkei is a bit of a psychological level. Given the rather firm tone that we have on stock markets generally and the additional weakness of the yen today, it could easily get above that level, but it is a bit overbought in the short term. Some consolidation in this region wouldn't be at all surprising, but a break of the progression of higher reaction lows would really be required to question the recovery potential in this market. When we take a step back and look at what's happening globally, there's a great deal of concern about what's going to happen in China with regard to their policy and how they're going to manage the slowdown in the property market. They have a priority, they've stated it repeatedly, that they want to narrow the income gap between the rich and poor. They want to create a more equitable society, but they want to do it while promoting rapid economic growth. Property prices had got to a level where it was a threat to the social contract that the Communist Party has helped to instill in the population. They've basically promised that they will provide an improving standard of living in return for power. So it's in the communists' interest to ensure that they can continue to supply an increasing standard of living for the majority of people. Higher property prices were a threat to that promise, so they were forced to act. They do not want a collapse in the property prices. We've seen that the government have begun to roll back on the hikes in the reserve requirements. They have also, in the last couple of weeks, they've changed their attitude towards their growth model. A couple of years ago, it became evident that the Chinese would get more from investing in their people than they would from investing in infrastructure. And we've seen a subtle change in how the policy has been structured. There's been the increasing provision of healthcare. There's been the widening of availability for social security in the cities to include the migrant workers. And there are over 300 million migrant workers in China. There has been a new focus on environmental concerns. Only in the last couple of weeks, Beijing has adopted an internationally accepted standard to monitor its pollution. And that's an important step because it was widely believed that their previous measure was massively underreporting the pollution measures. So you're starting to get slow but sure change. I posted an interesting chart during the week. It was from a report by Saracen. I think it was in either 2010 or 2011. And it shows a curve where high growth countries eventually move up the table in terms of per capita GDP, and their growth rate tends to fall along with it as the standard of living improves. That's likely to continue. China's unlikely to be any different. The per capita GDP is currently around between 3,000 and 4,000. As that increases, it'll be more difficult to maintain these outsized GDP growth figures. What we are starting to see is the evolution of an active middle class. And that's likely to be the really big important theme in China over the next decade. If the last decade was about infrastructure development, then the next decade is likely to be about the growth and development of the consuming class, particularly in China. India is probably the opposite. It already has an active and vibrant consumer class. It's missing the infrastructure. And that's also beginning to change. The Indian government is beginning to take a more activist approach to building the infrastructure that's required. So far, it's more or less relied on private enterprise to build its own infrastructure, to build the infrastructure that it needed. And that was particularly uncoordinated, where corporates had the ability to build their own infrastructure. They built it for their own needs. It wasn't particularly in the mind of the public good. And then you had individual states which have different infrastructure agendas, so that one may have a motorway to going to the end of their state line, and it's met with a dirt track on the other end. That type of development has probably reached as far as it's going to go. The Indians understand that they can't simply rest on their laurels, that they have to continue on the road towards increasing the exposure of their domestic market to the wider world, to developing their manufacturing centers. They've got a rapidly growing population. They've got well in excess of a billion people. The great defining characteristic of a number of Asian countries, particularly relative to some in the Middle East, is that they have a long-term plan to deal with their massive young populations. They understand that young people grow up and that they need the education today so that they'll be equipped to deal with a developing economy in the future. They understand that young people will need the infrastructure so that they'll need homes to live in, they'll need sewers, they'll need airports, telephones, and electricity, water. So that requires massive infrastructure development. India has been lagging. It's one of the highest growth economies in the world. That's likely to continue for quite a bit longer. GDP per capita in India is probably around $1,000 to $1,500. So it's got quite a long way to go before it is even in a semblance of attempting to catch up with where China is in terms of its development right now. Whereas you are starting to see a migration of low-cost manufacturing out of China. Some of that is heading towards India, where the unit labor costs are considerably lower. China's moving up the value chain in terms of its manufacturing. It's becoming increasingly difficult for low-income, high manual labor type operations to find cheap labor in China. They're either moving inland, they're either having to become more efficient, or they are moving abroad. India is definitely one of the beneficiaries. So are a number of the other ASEAN countries. And the ASEAN region generally has been among the very best performers over the last 6 months in particular. Of a very small number of markets that have moved to new all-time highs over the last 6 months, more than half of them are in the ASEAN region. The Philippines in particular has been particularly strong, and it's the market that has probably moved to a new high. It was one of the first to do so. It continues to remain very close to its new high. It's probably also one of the larger beneficiaries of a migration of low-cost labor. Thailand is also another market that has moved to a new high and held the majority of its advance. We remain in this secular theme, which is the greatest urbanization in history. It's the biggest migration the world is ever likely to see. And at one point, I think it was in 2008, that the world became more urban than it is rural. And it was at some point last year that China became more urban than it is rural. India still has a long way to go. Indonesia has allocated over $100 billion to build additional infrastructure. It's been changing its laws to enable the acquisition of property from farmers and the forced purchase orders and those types of reforms that allow big infrastructure projects to get built. We're seeing that type of evolution occurring right across a whole range of other markets. One thing that is quite noticeable in China today, I noticed it in October when I was there, I noticed it again last month, is the number of Africans that are in China. Most of what you hear in the media is about how active the Chinese are in Africa. China, for example, is building special economic zones in a number of countries, especially in Nigeria. What's less reported is that the Africans are in China sourcing cheap goods to supply their respective consumer markets back home. And if you go to the wholesale markets in parts of China, there are quite a large number of people from the Middle East and from Africa that are sourcing goods there. That reflects on a vibrant growth economy. The African region is considerably behind in terms of their economic development, and certainly in terms of the development of their capital markets. But they are quickly developing. And when we are talking today about infrastructure development in China and in India and in the ASEAN region, and indeed right across Latin America, Brazil in particular has got a huge amount of infrastructure to build to both alleviate some of the bottlenecks in its supply chain, but also to cater for the Olympics and for the World Cup. But I suspect that in 20 years' time, we're going to be talking about a big infrastructure boom in the majority of Africa. The Chinese are building infrastructure there now, specifically for their own needs, but it's an under-urbanized continent, and there's no reason that you won't have the same amount of urbanization in Africa in about 30 years' time that you do in the rest of the world today. So we're on a secular path toward more urbanization. Urbanization generally leads to a greater amount of, or a higher standard of living among the urbanites. Countries such as Canada and Australia have become quite dependent on commodity consumption, particularly in China. China's built an awful lot of infrastructure in the last 20 years, and particularly in the last decade. They're not about to stop building infrastructure. Per capita consumption of a large number of commodities is still below what would be considered normal, not simply in North America or Europe, but in some of the developed Asian markets. So we can anticipate that demand for commodities will remain robust, but it's unlikely to continue to grow from China at the same rate that we've seen previously. What is likely is that consumption from other countries is likely to ramp up considerably over the next decade. So while there is a great deal of worry in, particularly in Australia, where you have a widening focus or between those that are exposed to the commodity complex and doing very well indeed, and the rest of the economy that is losing competitiveness, that is suffering from the strength of the Australian dollar, and where the tourism sector is losing competitiveness, and that side of the economy is finding it really quite difficult. The fear is that there's a lot of infrastructure development going into the commodity complex, that at some point all of this new supply will eventually bring down prices, and that the surpluses that have been enabled by the commodity export market will evaporate, because prices will come down as supply increases. That's probably quite a long way out to the future. It takes a very long time to bring new supply on into the market. But a new supply hitting the market is the most common cause of a bust in a commodity market, or indeed any other market. And when it's accompanied with higher interest rates have killed off more bull markets than just about anything else. Central banks in places like Australia and Canada have got a very fine balancing act. They have to have interest rates high enough to cater for the inflationary impact of a commodity boom, and low enough to cater for the rather difficult environment that the domestic economy is in. It's certainly not going to be easy. Now, the Australian market, stock market, has been largely range-bound for the last year. It pulled back rather sharply early this week. It's recovered somewhat, along with just about everything else, in the latter half of the week. It needs to do substantially more to really indicate that demand is returning to dominance. We talked at length in the last few years about the need for Japan to have a weaker currency. It's probably the same is true of Australia at this point. If the economy or the stock market is likely to begin to perform at least in line with its regional neighbours, or indeed with Western markets, it's probably going to require a weaker currency. The banking sector has almost an equal weighting to Rio Tinto and BHP in the index. The banking sector is primarily the domestic market, and Rio and BHP probably are some of the best reflectors of the commodity bull market that there are. BHP also pulled back sharply in the first half of this week and recouped much of the gain into the latter half of the week. It's a volatile share. It's best bought following reactions, and it's been building support following a large reaction over the last few months. It's probably more likely than not to go up from this area. Perceptions are that that commodities are not going to be a particularly good performer in the short to medium term. I think there's a great deal of concern about the health of the Chinese economy. I think with regard to commodities, that really is to ignore a very, very big world out there. And the requirement for infrastructure development right across most of Asia and Latin America, the Middle East and Africa, is really quite considerable. The demand component is not the main consideration. It's the supply component. What we really do need to be aware of is just how much supply is due to come on market. Because whereas people tend to think that there is a limited supply of commodities, that's not strictly true. There is a limited supply of commodities at a given price. The higher prices go, the more supply becomes economic. So as supply hits the market, the demand component is likely to remain steady. If more and more supply hits the market, demand will be overwhelmed. That's what happened in the 1970s during the commodities bull market. It's likely to happen again in this one. I do not believe that we have hit that juncture just yet, but it does mean that we need to monitor what's happening with the supply side quite a bit more than worrying about the demand side of the equation. Gold has been in a period of consolidation for much of the last 6 months. It hit a peak over $1,900 in September. It's pulled back towards the 200-day moving average on successive occasions. It found at least near-term support in the region of the MA this week. I was a bit surprised to see that. Personally, I bought platinum rather than gold because I think it has a slightly more consistent pattern. Platinum has been undervalued, courtesy of a subscriber. We got some long-term price history for platinum from Johnson Matthey back in January. And when one looks at the ratio between gold and platinum, it's ranged between 1 and 2, one relative to the other, for much of the last 40 years. So that encompasses both bull and bear markets. Gold has been particularly strong relative to platinum over the last 6 months, and that outperformance is now being unwound. So there is continued potential for platinum to outperform in this environment. And as I said, it has a more consistent pattern than gold at present. We've had a difficult period over the last few months for gold. It's been quite volatile. Nothing has happened to really question the secular bull market. It continues to show signs that demand is dominant over the medium term, and the likelihood is that it will be able to move on to new high ground at some point this year. It does need to continue to hold its progression of higher reaction lows, and the fact that it bounced from its 200-day moving average this week represents another higher reaction low. So a move below this week's low would really be needed to question short-term potential for additional higher to lateral ranging and some additional support building. Once it begins to start moving back above the 1800 level, then it will look considerably more able to sustain a momentum move. It probably has a bit of work to do between now and then, though. U.S. treasuries have been ranging for the last 6 months. They're at historically extraordinarily high levels. Yields are at extraordinary lows. The market's being supported by government intervention. That's not a situation that's likely to continue indefinitely. The U.S. economy has the ability to throw off a number of the problems that it has. There's a lot of people worried about the deficits. There's a lot of people worried about the unfunded liabilities. There's a lot of people worried about the low growth environment and unemployment. But the USA also has the potential to become energy independent within the next decade. The supply of natural gas from unconventional sources is depressing prices. The price is currently at $2.32. That's some of the lowest energy there is just about anywhere. Natural gas in the USA is now competitive with coal. The supply is such that the USA is currently, there are people building export terminals so that the USA can export natural gas. The companies that are busy drilling for unconventional gas deposits, they've begun to switch to gas liquids because natural gas on its own at these levels is completely uneconomic. They're exploiting gas liquids because it's, from a refining perspective, it's equivalent to propane and to Texas Light Sweet. And they can get a number of high-priced products out of it. So that's where the companies are making money right now. They are biding their time until natural gas prices begin to recover once the demand component kicks in. If we know anything about the impact of supply and demand, it's that when you have a very cheap commodity relative to just about everything else, then people come up with new ideas how to use more of it to pick up the arbitrage. So anyone who's building a power station right now is building it to burn natural gas. The argument for using natural gas as a passenger fuel or a fuel for passenger vehicles is well made, particularly when you factor in that the price of oil is still at an historically high level. Brent crude this week got up to $125. It's been consolidating now in the region of a previous high and around the $125 level for the last couple of weeks. It continues to hold a progression of higher reaction lows. There's absolutely nothing has happened to question potential for it to continue to push higher in this environment. Now, that's not good news for the global economy. The last thing that anybody wants is unaffordable energy prices. It will have an economic impact over the medium term. The longer the prices remain higher, the longer it's going to take, or the greater the impact that they're going to have on the wider economy. From the perspective of a country that is likely to become energy independent, that's not especially bad news. The USA is producing more oil today than it has in at least a decade. And there's continued investment in increasing its oil supply, and that's likely to continue to increase. If you factor in the additional consumption of natural gas, then high oil prices would certainly be to the country's net favor. For the rest of the world, it's not going to be a particularly rosy scenario. I think higher oil prices, and particularly a potential spike in oil prices, is the one really credible threat to the stock market at present. It's unlikely to come, or oil prices are unlikely to fall meaningfully unless we have a concerted effort by various governments to bring down the price of oil. There is talk about a release from the Strategic Reserve to bring down US prices. That's unlikely to have a great effect on Brent crude, on which the majority of energy contracts globally are based. If we see that the wider economy does begin to slow, that will sap demand for oil. The cure for high prices is high prices. And that is a credible threat over the medium term. In the short term, we're seeing such a wall of money emanating from central banks hitting the wider global economy that the price of everything can continue to rise for a while longer. While oil remains in a momentum move, its effects are very real. So that really is the threat. That's what we're most worried about in terms of the concerns that are facing the market at present. But that's a medium-term risk. The short-term risk is that we see risk assets continuing to head higher. I think with that, I will leave you for the evening and wish all the best to all of you.